Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I will shortly be joined by Max Musson for today's presentation, which is on Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Let's lift our spirits then with our Greatest Briton for this week, and you've prepared the notes for this one, Max, so I'll let you introduce him.
Yeah, the Greatest Briton that we're going to discuss this week is actually a living person rather than somebody who's already died, and it is Sir Ranulph Fiennes. And I've referred on a couple of occasions in the past, when I've been making speeches, but also I think on these programmes, I've referred to Sir Ranulph Fiennes, and an occasion when I went to hear him speak, which I found very motivational, and it left a lasting effect on me. And so I think he is somebody who's well worth talking about. So his full name was Sir Ranulph Twistleton Wickham Fiennes. He's the third baronet of Banbury, and he was born on the 7th of March 1944. He's commonly known as Ranulph Fiennes, but often he's referred to as Ran for short. And he is a British explorer and a holder of several endurance records. He's also a writer, a poet, and a co-creator of the Sir Ranulph Fiennes Great British Rum, more of which I'll talk about later. According to the Guinness Book of Records, in 1984, he was the world's greatest living explorer. And Fiennes has written numerous books about his army service and his expeditions, as well as a book defending Robert Falcon Scott from modern revisionists. Fiennes served in the British Army for 8 years, including a period on counterinsurgency service while attached to the army of the Sultanate of Oman. And he later undertook numerous expeditions and was the first person to visit both the North Pole and the South Poles by surface means, and the first to completely cross Antarctica on foot. In May 2009, at the age of 65, he climbed to the summit of Mount Everest. So we're talking about somebody who's an incredible achiever, and even at the age of 65, willing to take part in an expedition to climb to the summit of Mount Everest, and he's still involved in expeditions today. And again, more about that later on.
All this exploring that he did he do that when he was young, or did he do that when he was older? Because I noticed that a lot of the things he's done is like the first to climb Mount Everest at that age. Now, was he doing this when he was very young, or is it something that he did when he sort of got to middle age?
No, he was doing it when he was younger, but obviously he had his period of military service, and it was, I think, towards the end of his period of military service that he started to get involved in exploration and these kind of expeditions. And then once he left military service, I'm not quite sure how old it was when he left military service. I imagine it's probably going to be sort of late 30s, 40s, something of that sort. Then he began doing these expeditions. So it's been in his 40s, 50s, 60s, and now 70s that he's been doing these sort of things. And so, you know, he's an example. A lot of people that I meet in life have perhaps reached the age of 60 and they started to feel that they're getting a bit old. And I remember once talking to a chap about, I used to be a financial advisor, and I was talking to this chap about a medium-term investment. And he sort of confessed to me at the age of 61 that he didn't think he could invest in a medium length investment because he didn't know whether he was still going to be here next year or not, which sort of made me burst out with laughter. I think that people who worry about getting old, and I've often said that, you know, if you're worrying about getting old, then read Jack London's book, The Mutiny on the Elsinore, which features a character who's the first mate on the ship, who is a man who's portrayed as being 70 years of age and who's still a swashbuckling kind of sailor who climbs around in the rigging, cuffing these younger sailors around the back of their head in order to speed them on, etc. And I often refer to that. But what I would also say now is to, you know, I'm not quite sure whether Ranulph Fiennes has written a biography. But if he has written a biography, or if somebody's written a biography about him, then I think that would be well worth getting, well worth reading, bearing in mind the age that he was at the time that he did a lot of these things, because it just makes people realize what you can do if you're determined enough and single-mindedly determined enough, I suppose.
Yeah, quite an inspiration. Quite an inspiration then for if people are, you know, elderly and thinking, well, I'm past it now, then, you know, you can look at Sereno Fines and realize that, well, you know, you don't have to be totally past it. If you work hard at it, you can keep at it. And he's still at it now, isn't he? Yeah, please That's continue, right. Max.
So Fines was born in Windsor in Berkshire on the 7th of March 1944, nearly 4 months after the death of his father, who was Lieutenant Colonel Sir Ranulph Twisleton Wickham Fines, who was commanding the Scots Greys in Italy, and unfortunately trod on an S mine, a shrapnel mine, and was killed. And he died of his wounds. This was in 1943. So Fines' mother was Audrey Joan, and she died in 2004. She was the younger daughter of Sir Percy Newsome, and Fines inherited his father's baronetcy, becoming the third Baronet of Banbury at his birth. Fines is a third cousin of Mark Fines, whose children include the actors Joseph and Ralph Fines, and he's a distant cousin to the royal family. So again, he's somebody who comes from a slightly sort of aristocratic background, and I've been a critic of the aristocracy on many occasions because of the effete character that has permeated its way through the aristocracy, turning a lot of them into fairly wimpish characters. But it would appear that the more manly genes that made our aristocrats of old such swashbuckling heroes has still permeated down to a number of people, Ranulph Fines being one of them. So after the war, his mother moved the family to South Africa, where he remained until he was 12. While in South Africa, he attended the Western Province Preparatory School in Newlands, Cape Town, and Fines then returned to be educated at Sandroyd School, Wiltshire, and then Eton College. According to his own website, he failed his A-level. So he wasn't a bookish kind of a character. He was somebody who obviously was already at that sort of stage, a man or a boy of action.
Can I just add something there, Max? It looks like he's, I mean, he lost his father before he was even born. His mother was widowed, it looks like, just before he was born. So he was, I mean, he's brought up without a father figure there. I don't know if she married again, but that is a massive credit for somebody to be brought up without his father there and still turn into the man that he turned into. I mean, that's all credit to his genes, but also to his mother, I would suggest. She must have done a very good job of bringing him up, wouldn't you say?
I would say so, yes, absolutely. But I think that being educated in South Africa at that time, he would have benefited from the rather more, I suppose, old-fashioned, you know, what could be described as old-fashioned in parentheses, schooling techniques that probably would have prevailed in schools in South Africa at the time versus the more sort of progressive education systems and things that would have been that were gradually introduced in the UK over the post-war period. So perhaps that had something to do with that.
Yeah, colonial education system.
That's right, because a lot of people, you know, even West Indians have said, you know, that the education system that they had in the West Indies during the 50s and the 60s, which was still far more like the education system that existed in pre-war Britain, was something that was fundamental to their development and which they benefited from tremendously. So, you know, I would imagine that still would have existed in South Africa to some extent.
Yeah, they wouldn't have taught them to the lowest common denominator. They would have pushed them to be as best as they could, and they would have streamed them into the brightest people in one section and the less bright people in the other, and with a lot of discipline as well, I would have thought.
Yes. Yes, I would certainly say so. So moving on to his career, after graduating from Mons Officer Cadet School. Now, Mons Officer Cadet School is a sort of counterpart to Sandhurst. Both of those two officer cadet schools are in the same sort of part of the country in Hampshire. But he graduated from Mons Officer Cadet School in July 1963. and he served in his father's regiment, the Royal Scots Greys, but was then seconded to the SAS, where he specialised in demolitions. Fiennes distinguished himself by becoming the youngest captain in the British Army, but his service life was enlivened by various scrapes and escapades, including on one occasion when Fiennes and another officer procured a very lively squirming piglet, covered it in tank grease, and slipped it into the crowded ballroom of the officers of the Army's Staff College, Camberley. And so you can imagine that as kind of like a joke, two people finding a piglet, covering it with grease, and just letting it loose in a ballroom kind of situation would have been hilariously funny.
They would have made everybody really covered in muck, wouldn't they? I mean, all their best clothes.
So what this reveals is that Ranulph Fiennes, you know, besides being a very sort of seriously minded person and a very determined person, is also somebody that's got a devilish kind of sense of humour as well. On another occasion, offended by the construction of an ugly concrete dam built by 20th Century Fox for the production of the film Dr. Dolittle in a Wiltshire village of Castle Combe, he reportedly, which is reputedly the prettiest village in England, Fiennes planned to demolish the dam. He used explosives, which he later claimed to have accumulated from leftovers on training exercises, and using skills from a recently completed training course on evading search dogs by night, he escaped capture, but he and a guilty colleague were both subsequently traced. Disagreed with the building of this dam and decided to demolish it with one of his colleagues, which they obviously then did. But then were caught, and after a court case, Fiennes had to pay a large fine, and he and his co-conspirator were discharged from the SAS. So again, it's sort of somebody the type of mind that if you see something that you think is wrong, then you go out and try and do what you can to put it right. And again, somebody who's already developing a sense of adventure, because I'm sure finds that at the age that he was then would have regarded this as a tremendous wheeze and something which would be like a little bit of a mini adventure that he and his colleague could get themselves involved in, using their SAS skills in order to complete it.
Well, it shows he's got character, doesn't it? And also it shows that he's got an appreciation for his surroundings and the British countryside. I mean, that's the most beautiful village in England, and you've got this hideous carbuncle there of a monstrosity, this concrete dam that Hollywood has put there. So why not just blow it up? I bet he had all the support of the village as well in actually doing that.
You can imagine he would have done. Yes.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Yeah, it shows you that he's a good man, isn't he? He's got some good ideas there. He's got his head screwed on right.
Okay. So becoming disillusioned by his British Army service, in particular his career prospects, he spent the last 2 years of his service seconded to the army of the Sultan of Oman. At the time, Oman was experiencing a growing communist insurgency supported from neighbouring South Yemen. Fiennes had a crisis of confidence soon after arriving in Oman as he became aware of the Sultan's poor government. However, he decided that the oppression threatened by a communist takeover combined with moves towards progressive change within the Sultanate system justified his part in the conflict. After familiarisation, he commanded the reconnaissance platoon of the Muscat Regiment, seeing extensive service in the Dhofar region. He led several raids deep into rebel-held territory on the Jebel Dhofar, and was decorated for bravery by the Sultanate. After 8 years' service, Fiennes relinquished his commission in July 1971. So he was born in 1944, which then means that he would have been 26, 27 at that point.
Fairly young. Well, I find it interesting there that he's already looking at it and thinking, well, there's a bit of a moral quandary here, but he's been asked to support the Sultan of Oman and fight against the communists, and the Sultan of Oman is obviously not a very good person, but neither are the communists, so it's got to be the lesser of two evils that he ends up supporting here, and it shows that he sees that being anti-communism is more important. So I think this shows you that he's got a nationalist ideal, really. If you see nationalism as opposed to communism, anyone who's opposed to communism is leans towards nationalism, I would suggest, and joining the army anyway. shows that he's a patriot.
And the demolishing of that dam showed traditionalism, doesn't it? And traditionalism is a thread of nationalism as well. So expedition leader. Since the 1960s, Fiennes has been an expedition leader. He led expeditions up the White Nile on a hovercraft in 1968 to 69 and two onto Norway's Jostedalsbreen Glacier in 1967 and 1970. One notable trek was the Transglobe expedition he undertook between 1979 and 82, when he and two fellow members of 21 SAS, Oliver Shepherd and Charles Burton, journeyed around the world on its polar axis using surface transport only. This three-year, 52,000-mile odyssey took intricate planning, 1,900 sponsors and a 52-person team to handle the complex communications, meticulous planning and iron determination mixed with flexibility. The circumnavigation has never been successfully repeated. So, again, that's something that he achieved with two of his other ex-SAS colleagues an achievement that that nobody else has actually ever replicated. And so with three men having done that, fewer people have done that than have walked on the moon. Which sort of puts 50 years ago, really,
doesn't it? 50 years ago as well. In 50 years, that's nobody else has managed to do it. With all the increases in technology, in clothing, all the sort of things that we've had that mean that it's easier to go to the Arctic now than ever before, and still nobody else has managed to do it. And that's pretty
incredible. This is putting Ranulf Fiennes into the same sort of category as people like Shackleton, who, as we've discussed on previous weeks, who led expeditions to the poles and endured the sort of horrendous cold, etc., necessary in order to do that.
3 years. Ranulf Fiennes actually spent doing that. So if I'm understanding this correctly, that's 3 years spent in the Arctic in the polar conditions. If he's working.
Well, I think it would have been 3 years also traveling by boat, sort of between the two polar areas, because it wasn't just crossing the actual polar part, it was crossing the poles and also circumnavigating the world by crossing both poles.
On the polar axis, it says, doesn't it?
That's it, yeah. So as part of the Transglobe expedition, Fiennes and Burton completed the Northwest Passage. They left, there's a name of a place here, which is going to be very difficult to pronounce, Tuktoyaktuk, on the 26th of July 1981 in an 18-foot open Boston whaler. So again, this is the same size of boat that Shackleton's men left the ice sheet in the Antarctic for and made their way to not the Falkland Islands,
Elephant
but Stanley Island.
Island,
isn't it?
Elephant Island, wasn't it? And Shackleton went
Elephant
to.
Island, that's right, yeah, Elephant Island, that's right. So again, the same sort of sized boat, an 18-foot open Boston whaler, and reached Tankery Ford on the 31st of August 1981. The journey was the first open boat transit from west to east, and covered around 3,000 miles. So again, an epic journey, again, just as part of the expedition, an epic journey. In 1992, Fiennes led an expedition that discovered what may be an outpost of the lost city of Iram in Oman. Iram is a legendary city that's described by, in certain quarters, as being the Atlantis of the sand. So it's a city of fable that apparently did exist or is believed to have existed in the past, but of which there is little or no trace today. But Ranulf Fiennes found what he believes is the part of that lost city.
Well, that's amazing. They can still find things to this day, isn't it? That they can still find archaeological treasures that that haven't been discovered before. And this is, 30 years ago? And you've got this explorer and he discovers the ruins of something that people have been searching for centuries, or that's been lost for centuries. So there are still hidden treasures out there. So it's encouraging to hear that somebody such as Ranulf Fiennes found one of them while he was out there.
Absolutely. So the following year, he joined nutrition specialist Dr. Mike Stroud to become the first to cross the Antarctic continent unsupported. They took 93 days. And so this is crossing without having any a support team that's going to be sort of following along behind and carrying all the provisions, etc. for you. This is where they've had to cross the ice sheet, taking everything that they needed with them.
Did they have dogs, or were they dragging a sled behind them, do you know, or was it entirely under their own power?
I don't know the answer to that question, I have to say, but that's something that our listeners might like to research for themselves. It will be, you know, very interesting for them to do the research and to come up with the answer. So a further attempt in 1996 to walk to the South Pole solo in aid of the breast cancer campaign was unsuccessful due to a kidney stone that Fiennes had, and he had to be rescued from the operation by his crew. In 2000, at the age of 56, he attempted to walk solo and unsupported to the North Pole. So again, another sort of very arduous thing at an age when most men would be thinking about their early retirement. Fiennes sustained severe frostbite. Fiennes sustained severe frostbite to the tips of his fingers on his left hand, forcing him to abandon the attempt. On returning home, his surgeon insisted the necrotic fingertips be retained for several months before amputation to allow regrowth and of the remaining healthy tissue. But impatient at the pain of the dying fingertips, Fiennes cut them off himself with an electric fret saw. Can you imagine that?
As incredible.
So Fiennes cut them off with an electric fret saw just above where the blood and the soreness was. And so if you see photographs of Ralph Fiennes since then, he's obviously got shorter fingers on one hand. I think it's just like the final digit of each finger that he cut off. But again, this sort of exemplifies the single-minded determination of somebody who I would imagine he probably had realised that the tips of his fingers had started to go gangrenous, and was probably, despite the sort of insistence by his doctors, was probably worried that the gangrene would spread to the rest of his fingers and he'd end up losing his whole hand or something of that sort, which for a man of his sort would have been, you know, a terrible loss. So, you know, just decided that it was better to lose the tips of his fingers rather more brutally than most people would imagine possible, and did the job himself with an electric fret saw.
He must have realized when he was out there that his fingers were going, but he must have thought, well, I'll just power through it, and I'll still need to make the end of the mission, rather than calling in for help.
And the time when I went to see him speak, I'm not quite sure whether that was just after this expedition, but it was around about that same sort of time. It was somewhere between 1995 and 2005. But when I went to see him speak, one of the things that impressed me was the fact that he mentioned that in a previous expedition that he had been walking and that he could feel his feet getting colder and colder and number and number. And then he kind of realized at that point that frostbite had set in and that there was a danger that he would lose some of his toes. He told us on that occasion that he had lost several toes off of his feet as a result of gangrene setting in as a result of frostbite. So, you know,
so he's already lost his toes then. I mean, the big thing is that he lost his fingers and cut his fingers off. But before that, he's already lost bits of his toes as well to frostbite.
That's right. And still it hasn't stopped him. He's just carried on, which is like amazing. Despite suffering from a heart attack and undergoing a double heart bypass operation just 4 months before, Fiennes joined Stroud again in 2003 to complete 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents in the Land Rover 7x7x7 challenge for the British Heart Foundation. And one of the things that you'll be picking up as we go through these various attempts is that progressively, Ranulph Fiennes is completing these expeditions on a sponsorship basis, where the money raised by that sponsorship is used for charitable purposes. And so Land Rover obviously organized this 7x7x7 challenge, and Fiennes entered the challenge together with his colleague Stroud.
And so while recovering from a heart attack.
Having recovered from a heart attack and a double bypass operation, that's right. And so, again, amazing stuff. And then the marathons that he completed were one in Patagonia in South America, one in the Falkland Islands, which was intended to be the Antarctic marathon, then one in Sydney, Australia, Singapore in Asia, London in Europe, and Cairo in Africa. And then the very last race was in New York City in North America. Speaking after the event, Fiennes said the Singapore Marathon had been by far the most difficult because of the high humidity and the pollution. He also said his cardiac surgeon had approved the marathons, providing his heart rate did not exceed 130 beats per minute. But Fiennes later said that he forgot to pack his heart rate monitor and therefore didn't know how fast his heart was beating while he was running, so which again is sort of illustrates the character of the man.
He's just determined to complete what he's doing, isn't he? That's more important to him than anything else. I mean, if he has a heart attack, he has a heart attack, but he's going to complete what he said he would complete. He's going to follow through on his promise, keep his word. I should say that's the way his mind works.
So in June 2005, Fiennes had to abandon an attempt to be the oldest Briton to climb Mount Everest when in another climb for charity, he was forced to turn back as a result of heart problems. Again, he suffered, I think, another heart attack doing this. And this was after reaching the final stopping point of the ascent. In March 2007, despite a lifelong fear of heights, Fiennes climbed the Eiger by its north face, with sponsorship totaling $1.8 million to be paid to the Marie Curie Cancer Care Delivering Choice Program. And so 2007, when he would have then been, 61? That's, when he climbed the north face of the Eiger. In 2008, Fiennes made his second attempt to climb Mount Everest, getting to within 400 meters of the summit before bad timing and bad weather stopped the expedition. But then,
hang on a sec, Max. I mean, back in 2005, I mean that first attempt he made at it, he almost got to the top and then had to stop because he'd had a heart attack. I mean, this must be really hard on him. He gets almost to the top there and then he has to stop. Then he makes a second attempt 3 years later, and on the second attempt he gets 400 meters from the top, and then he has to stop once again. I mean, he's really getting some knockbacks here, isn't he? Must be, the disappointment at getting all that way and then having success just snatched away from you. But it doesn't get him down.
This is like a lesson in never giving up, isn't it? You know, I can remember the story of Robert the Bruce in the cave with the spider being told to me when I was a small child. But the story of Ranulph Fiennes ranks alongside that in terms of, you know, never giving up. Try it and get as far as you can, and the next time try even harder until you get there. So on May 2009, Fiennes reached the summit of Mount Everest, becoming the oldest British person to achieve this, and in doing so also became the first person ever to have climbed Everest and crossed both polar ice caps. In September 2012, it was announced that Fiennes was to lead the first attempt to cross Antarctica during the southern winter. And this was then entitled the Coldest Journey Expedition. It was in aid of charity, with charity of Seeing is Believing, an initiative to prevent avoidable blindness. However, Fiennes had to pull out of this expedition because of frostbite. So I guess that once you've suffered frostbite once, it probably makes you a bit more susceptible to getting frostbite again, because quite a lot of the capillary blood vessels and things would have been damaged with the first bout of frostbite.
He's also 68 years old now, crossing Antarctica, two years off 70. You know, when I mean, people retire at the age of 65, don't they?
Yeah, that's right.
And
in 2015, he became the oldest Briton at the time to complete the what was described as the toughest foot race on Earth, which is the Marathon des Sables, which I believe is in North Africa, where that marathon is held. And that was in aid of Marie Curie again.
Well, I would suggest that the heat is the hardest thing to work against when you're running these marathons, because you said Singapore was the hardest one out of those seven, and this one is supposed to be the toughest race on earth. So when you're running in the cold, when you're running in the Antarctic, I guess because you're working up all that body heat when you're running, and rather than sweating and getting fatigued from that, you've got that cool air. So it's probably easier running in the colder climates, very cold climates, than it is running in these hot climates, I would suggest.
Yeah, lots of people I know that do lots of running have said that it's much easier to run in light drizzle than it is in sunshine, because the drizzle obviously cools you down and adds moisture to you as you're breathing, whereas if you're running in the heat and the dry, you're getting overheated, and also your throat and your lungs are becoming dry as a result of that.
Is it 28 miles a marathon?
Is it 26?
26. Hard work in the best of times, let alone in conditions like there's some snow or desert and hot weather. Hard work at the best of times.
Yes, that's right. The last thing in terms of the expeditions and things that Ranulph Fiennes has been taking part in is that he is currently fundraising for another expedition, and he's spent at least 3 years in trying to raise funds for this expedition. And one of the things that was impressed upon me when I went and heard Ranulph Fiennes speak was the fact that he pointed out to everybody that taking part in these expeditions isn't something that you just suddenly decide to do. It's something that you have to sit down and meticulously plan over a period of time, right down to, with one of his Arctic expeditions, he had to hire the boat, work out how much the ship was going to cost in order to sail down there, calculate how many people he would need in a crew. They would need to have helicopters on standby in case things went wrong or people had to be helicoptered out. And that he had to calculate how many portions of food they would need to last them for the months that it was going to be taking, or the years that it was going to be taking to complete the expeditions. And so he would have this very, very detailed itinerary, which would come up with a total figure of the amount of money that he needed to have. And he was talking about one particular expedition, either that he just finished or he was about to start, which where he estimated it would cost £10 million to complete the expedition. And he then, having calculated that, had then given himself 10 years to raise the £10 million. But as I say, this last expedition, the current expedition that he's involved in, is called the Global Reach Challenge. And it says on his website is Sir Ranulph Fiennes has announced his next record-breaking challenge, in which he will be risking life and limb to raise vital funds for the charity Marie Curie again. The intrepid explorer is attempting to complete the Global Reach Challenge and become the first person to have crossed both polar ice caps and have climbed the highest mountain on each continent. To follow his progress over the coming months, support Sir Ranulph Fiennes' challenge in aid of Marie Curie by visiting Just Giving. That's justgiving.com/Ranulph. If you go to that page now, he's already got pledges of £316,000. So again, even at the age that he is today, which is 76, he's still undertaking these kind of challenges and is a remarkable example to people. And if anybody wants to be motivated in the way that I was motivated by hearing him speak the first time, then Ranulph Fiennes is halfway through, and he's halfway through because the coronavirus restrictions have put a temporary stop to this, but he's halfway through a speaking tour which is called the Living Dangerously Tour. And what I can tell you is that he's going to be visiting dozens of cities all over the UK, delivering this speech. The tickets vary from location to location, but they're all around about £30, somewhere between about £27.50 and £35. But the next time that he's going to be speaking, he's going to be on the 10th of October 2020 at the Lighthouse Theatre in Kettering. If anybody's interested in booking to see him speak, they can go to, if you've got a pen and paper handy, it is www.ents24/UK/tour-dates/Sir-Ranulph, spelled Ranulph, www.ents-finds, F-I-E-N-N-E-S. So www.ents24/UK/tour-dates/Sir-Ranulph-Finds. And what I can say to you is that if you go and hear him speak, he's a very inspirational character and well worth the £30 that you'll pay.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Well, we're lucky that he's still going on a speaking tours and people can go and see him. Hopefully the coronavirus will clear up and people can get out there and hear him. And also, I was just thinking about these expeditions, and you were saying there about all the planning that went into them. I mean, it's no good actually getting there and then realizing that actually you need a little bit of more of this, or actually you forgot to bring this with you. There's no shops around on the Antarctic. Everything's got to be thought out, absolutely everything that you need to take with you. But also, it needs to be as light as possible. Especially if it's just him actually on this mission and he's dragging the sledge himself or carrying the equipment himself, he's got to be taking the absolute bare minimum that he needs to survive. And it's all got to be worked out, the weight of it, the nutrition of it, the planning that must go into these expeditions of his is phenomenal. Should we get into the second part of our presentation on Sir Ranulph Fiennes now, Max?
Yes.
Yeah, well, let's start with a bit of a recap with what we went into last week. I thought there were a couple of things that we could have gone into a little bit more. He went to Eton College, which we didn't really talk about very much. And that's really the poshest college in Britain, isn't it? Am I right in thinking that? Or is that Eton School? That's the one that
it's the poshest public school in Britain, yes.
Yeah,
public school. For any American listeners, a public school isn't a school for the public. A public school in Britain, it means it's a private school where only the children of the wealthiest attend.
So he really didn't need to have gone into the army and done all the things that he did. He could really have just been part of the aristocracy and used the connections that he made at Eton College. And also the fact that he didn't actually get any A-levels, and yet he still went to this college. I guess his family must have thought, well, even though you're not really that academic, we want you to go to this college anyway because we would like you to make those connections. But he still went out and joined the army and joined the SAS. And as we heard last week, they got this greasy pig and they threw that into the bowl. And just I was just thinking about that. And last week we said, well, that would have made all their suit and tie and ballroom dresses, it would have made them all very dirty. It also would have been very, very hard to catch this piglet that was covered in grease that was flying around the hall. And we also heard about him blowing up a concrete dam that had been built by Hollywood that was a hideous carbuncle on the most picturesque village in England. And then he fought the communists for Sultan of Oman. And then he went back there and discovered the Atlantis of the Sands in 1992, the lost city of Ubar. And I had a look into that, and some people have questioned whether that actually was the lost city that he found, but he definitely did find something there, ruins that have been lost for centuries. And then we talked about some of his expeditions, and we asked whether his expedition used sleds that were dragged along by dogs. And in 1993, he actually became the first person to cross the Antarctic continent on foot, dragging a 450-pound sledge. So he was dragging this sledge himself. And that's a quarter of a ton, isn't it? I think a ton is 1,000 kilos, and that's 2,200 pounds. So 450-pound sledge, that's a quarter of a ton that he was dragging across the Antarctic on foot. We talked about how he got frostbite and he cut his own fingertips off. And I just wanted to make a point about that. I've had to do blood tests at home before, and you get like a little plastic device with a lance inside it, a needle inside it. And you can't actually see the needle, but you just have to push this little bit of plastic against your finger to make a little pinprick so that you can then squeeze the blood out into a little test tube. And the difficulty you have with doing that, the difficulty there is with actually injuring yourself in some way, to think that he cut his fingertips off with a buzzsaw, It's just it was incredible.
An electric fret saw.
Electric fret saw. I mean, just, you know, incredible. I mean, the difficulty I have just putting this pin into my finger, and to think that he was able to just put his hands through a fret saw is just incredible. And then we talked about the marathons that he had run in the Arctic and in the tropics, how he'd almost climbed Everest but stopped because he was having heart problems, and then he tried to climb it again and he almost got to the top, and then there was bad weather, and then finally he became the oldest person to climb Everest, and he had lots of other Antarctic expeditions and marathons that he ran, and we covered most of his expeditions, and then I think we got up to the bit where we were going to start talking about some of the books that he'd written and some of the talks that he'd given. Was there anything else that you wanted to revisit there, Max, that we talked about last week?
Not only just that, one thing that's just occurred to me is that you've mentioned the lost city of Ubar. I described it last week as being the lost city of Iram, and apparently there is some dispute as to what the actual name of this place is, but Iram and Ubar are in fact the same place, just in case anybody else is looking these things up separately as a result of the discussion that we're having. So they are the same place, there's a little bit more that I'll say about that later on, but we'll save that for the time being. But as far as Randolph Fiennes is concerned, he, despite having been a professional soldier, in addition to having been a professional soldier, in addition to having been an expedition leader, he's also become an author, because obviously you can't do these kind of expeditions without having a log, and once you've got a log, it's the logical thing for you to do, to actually turn the log into a book and write about it that way. But Randolph Fiennes has also written a number of fiction books. So he's written 24 fiction and non-fiction books in total. And in 2003, he published a biography of Captain Robert Falcon Scott, which attempted to provide a robust defence of Scott's achievements and reputation, which had been strongly questioned by biographers such as Roland Huntford. Although others have made comparisons between Fiennes and Scott, Fiennes says, he identifies more with Lawrence Oates, another member of Scott's doomed Antarctic team, than he does actually with Scott. Although I think that's perhaps just a bit of modesty on Randolph Fiennes' part there.
I would say that, for somebody to criticise him, I mean, unless they've actually been to the Antarctic and actually done the same things as Captain Scott actually did, then they haven't got a leg to stand on to be criticising him. I mean, this is the reason why he wrote the book, isn't it? Because he'd actually gone through exactly the same trials and tribulations that Scott had. So he's eminently qualified to write this book. And you've just got this biographer that's criticising him?
Well, I think what you have in the world of academia nowadays is a number of people who write biographies that are revisionist biographies of people who are the finest Britons, for example. They specifically seek out people who have been models for other people to follow and who are inspirational, and they then they write a biography of the person where they then pick them to pieces based upon modern day standards and modern day conventions, rather than viewing the person in the round and viewing them living at a time in the kind of environment they would have been living in at the time of their life. And I think that there is, sadly, and I think we've kind of touched on this in the past, there is an industry that sets out to besmirch the reputations of anybody who is somebody who's inspirational and admirable from our past, in order that we will have a diminished sense of identity and a diminished sense of national pride. And I think that it's excellent that Randolph Fiennes has come to the rescue of Captain Scott and defended him in the way that he has.
Also, the fact that he's managed to write 24 books after not actually getting any A-levels. I mean, that's quite an achievement. 24 fiction and non-fiction books for somebody that's not academically minded. And they're well-received books. It's not like he's a bad writer. So that's another credit to him that I wanted to mention. Sorry to interrupt you there, Max.
No, I think it's quite a common thing, actually, that you get people who fail to I think how the teachers describe it as a child failing to live up to its potential when they're at school sometimes. And very often it's not a matter that it's more a matter that the child is bored at school or feels depressed and constrained by all of the petty school rules that inhibits their learning, rather than that they're not intelligent enough to learn things. And I think that, you know, anybody who can plan and carry out an expedition in the way that Svanov Fiennes has done on several occasions, you know, would have to be somebody of exceptional ability just by definition. And so, you know, what you say is obviously true. But we're moving on now to just sort of look briefly at his political views. And one of the things that I worried about, and that I've sort of said to you a little bit earlier on, is that I think we should make it quite clear to anybody who's listening that there is absolutely no connection between Svanov Fiennes and Real Britannia or the Radio Albion. You know, we are not promoting him because we believe he's one of us or anything of that sort. He's not a member of any organization that we're a member of or anything like that. He is just an all-round good guy who we've identified as being a shining example to other people in the country, and somebody who should be emulated. But as far as his political views are concerned, it's known that he stood for the Countryside Party. And I have to confess my ignorance here. I'm not really quite sure what the Countryside Party stood for, though it sounds as if it's going to be a traditionalist kind of party, which is what one would expect of somebody with Svanov Fiennes' background.
I think it was. I think it was to do with stop the banning of fox hunting law. Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think they had a huge march, and they did have lots of support. So he was probably supporting that traditionalism. As we saw earlier or last week, we talked about how he must be a traditionalist because he didn't like this dam, this concrete dam, and took steps to get rid of it. So that sort of shows that he's got traditionalist leanings anyway. And also he when he was fighting against the communists, that shows that he's got patriotic leanings or right leaning rather than left leaning political views, I would suggest.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It's also been reported on a number of occasions, or alleged on a number of occasions, that he was a patron of the of UKIP. He's denied that, and I don't think there is actually any real evidence to suggest that he was. So, you know, that's perhaps just a misleading footnote in the accounts of him that are online, but he is by all accounts a member of the libertarian pressure group, the Freedom Association. Not that I'm very familiar with what the Freedom Association are trying to promote, but one of the things that Svanov Fiennes did in 2014 was that he was one of 200 public figures who were signatories to a letter to the Guardian opposing Scottish independence in the run-up to that September's referendum on that issue. So again, that kind of all fits in with somebody who is conservative with a small c, somebody who's a traditionalist, which, as we say, generally tends to fit with other aspects of Svanov Fiennes' character.
He's probably an unofficial patron. Maybe he had donated to UKIP and the Libertarian Pressure Group. The Freedom Party, I mean, libertarians support freedom of speech, don't they? So I suspect he's a supporter of freedom of speech, and that's great to hear that he supports libertarianism. Again, that's you know, it's very close to nationalism. I'd say the guy's probably definitely a patriot, although we can't say for certain.
Yes, I think that would be fairly clear to say. In terms of media appearances, he's made several TV appearances as a guest on the TV program Top Gear. He was a star in a reasonably priced car. So he did went around the test track in the Suzuki Liana that they provided for celebrities to do this in, and apparently lapped the in 1:51, which put him 26 out of the 65 celebrities that had taken part. So not a dazzlingly fast driver, but not too but nonetheless sort of pretty much middle of the pack, I suppose that puts him there. And he also appeared in a Polar Special episode of Top Gear, where because of the sort of overly jocular and lots, you know, unserious way in which the Top Gear crew were conducting themselves, because they thought that this whole thing was, you know, a bit of a laugh and a bit of a joke. Apparently, Ranulf Fiennes ended up berating them for their flippant attitude towards the dangers of the Arctic. And I imagine that he probably could foresee other people watching a flippant program about the Arctic, then thinking that it would be quite easy to try to emulate his exploits, and then getting themselves into trouble because they had underestimated the difficulties and the dangers involved. And so you can understand why he would have taken up that sort of a position.
There are places in Britain that have Arctic conditions, you know, the Cairngorms up in Scotland. There are places like that, and you could imagine that there would be idiots that would just go up there and not take the proper protective gear, go up there thinking, oh, it's a nice sunny day, not realise that, you know, you've got ice cold conditions there. The top of Scotland is actually part of the Arctic Circle, isn't it? It's quite unique, really, when you think of Britain, the long size of it. I think it's, was it 700 miles up to Scotland? And it's right sort of north and south. Yeah. So you get quite a difference in temperature just travelling up and down the country, like a marked difference in temperature and also in light, especially on Midsummer's Day. You know, it's light almost right the way through up in Scotland. And I guess maybe they even see the Northern Lights at times.
I don't know whether Scotland extends actually into the Arctic Circle, but it's not going to be a long way off. I've certainly flown to Scotland on a number of occasions and taken off in southern England in sort of reasonably bright and sunny conditions, and then got off the plane in Scotland with it being, dusk has already fallen upon Scotland. And so you can see that there is a marked difference there, and a marked difference in temperature as well, in the way that you've indicated, you know, it being like a couple of degrees colder by the time you get to Scotland. And also, interestingly, Ranulf Fiennes is alleged to have been considered for the role of James Bond, which I thought was quite amusing. And I think that Ranulf Fiennes found it quite amusing as well, because he mentioned that he was rejected by Cubby Broccoli for having hands that were too big and a face like a farmer. And apparently the role was then given to Roger Moore, who's evidently regarded as much prettier.
Has he got any acting credentials then? Has he tried acting at all? Or was this just, you know, well, maybe we could try Ranulf Fiennes just because he was a famous adventurer?
Yeah, I think it's because he's a famous adventurer. I've only ever met Ranulf Fiennes the once, or seen him the once, because I didn't really get to speak to him personally, apart from sort of cheering from the crowd. But he was, you know, I went to hear him speak, and he didn't strike me as the sort of person who would make a natural actor. And I can see that the humour in him being described in the way he was by Cubby Broccoli, if indeed that's what Cubby Broccoli actually said. But there we are. And he's featured in the game show Countdown on a number of occasions. And he's been an expert guest commentator on some documentaries. There was one documentary entitled Chasing Shackleton, which aired in January 2014, and he does make corporate and after dinner speeches, and I can tell you that his corporate and after dinner speeches would be pretty good and well worth going to listen to if you get the opportunity. And so, you know, as we mentioned last week, he has got a number of speaking engagements for the latter part of this year and the early part of next year, so they would be well worth attending from that point of view.
I'd like to see that documentary. I'll look that one out.
Documentary. In 2009, he appeared in a three-part National Geographic documentary, Egypt, with the world's greatest explorer. And it was also titled Fiennes Return to Egypt. And he appeared in this with his cousin, who's the actor Joseph Fiennes. And they retraced the expedition that he had conducted in Egypt back in the 1960s.
So he has a brother that's an actor. So he does have acting connections there.
He has acting connections, yes. It may just be the impression I had of him that he wasn't somebody who looked like the sort of person who would make an actor. Although I may be wrong on that, and perhaps we'll see him in some kind of starring role in the fullness of time. But
he's an all round good guy, isn't he? He's just sort of good at everything that he picks up, really, isn't he?
Yeah, I would think he's the sort of person that probably would try his hand at something like that. Now, one of the aspects of the expeditions, etc., because some people might be sort of listening to what we've been saying these last couple of weeks and think to themselves, yeah, but why would anybody put themselves through those kind of physical strains and stresses and mental strains and stresses, you know, in order to do these things, to be the first man, the first person to circumnavigate the Earth, crossing both poles, etc. Why strive to be the oldest man to have climbed the Eiger, or the north face of the Eiger, and the oldest man to have climbed Mount Everest, etc. A great part of the expeditions that Ranulf Fiennes has taken part in has been fundraising for charitable purposes. And just sort of moving on to his personal life, it then becomes sort of obvious, why he has been so sort of energetic in fundraising. What it says, picked out of Wikipedia here, is that Fiennes married his childhood sweetheart, Virginia, otherwise known as Ginny Pepper, on the 9th of September 1970, and they ran a country farm in Exmoor, Somerset, where they raised cattle and sheep. Ginny built a herd of Aberdeen Angus cattle while Fiennes was away on his expeditions. The extent of her support for him was so great that she became the first woman to receive the Polar Medal. The two remained married until her death from stomach cancer in February 2004. Fiennes embarked on a lecture tour where in Cheshire he met Louise Millington, who he married at St. Boniface Church, Banbury, 1 year and 3 weeks after Ginny's death. A daughter, Elizabeth, was born in April 2006, and he also has a stepson named Alexander.
So you think he was doing these expeditions because of going through his wife dying of stomach cancer? Because I noticed that a lot of these were for Marie Curie, for the cancer charity.
That's absolutely correct, yes. So I think that his wife dying in the way that she did spurred him on then to use the expeditions for primarily fundraising purposes. And that's why I think we went through the amount of fundraising that he's done. I think he's raised something like £14 million and was awarded as one of the greatest celebrity fundraisers in this country, and I think that's down to the fact that he lost his wife to cancer.
Yeah, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
So in 2003, while attempting to scale Mount Everest, Fiennes suffered a heart attack and later underwent emergency bypass surgery. Then
how did they do that? How did they do that? I mean, what, on the mountain? They did the bypass surgery?
No. He'd have been taken back. But he suffered a heart attack and was rescued. But then I think, he then underwent the emergency bypass surgery. And so,
not many facilities in Nepal, are there? I mean, you're not going to expect very many, hospital facilities at the top of Everest and in Nepal and Kashmir. It's not going to be like European facilities.
No, well, I doubt that the bypass surgery was done there. He would have been transported back to civilization to have that done, I'm sure.
What a place to have a heart attack on the top of Mount Everest.
Not the sort of place you'd want to do that. But the point is that this is all part of his character. A lot of these expeditions have been done when he has been, what most people regard as middle-aged at least, or in some people they would have been looking forward to putting their feet up and enjoying their retirement. He's been in his 60s when he's accomplished many of these expeditions, and not only has he been in his 60s, but he's completed expeditions whilst he has subsequent to having suffered heart attacks and subsequent to having had emergency bypass surgery, etc. And one of the last expeditions that he went on, I think I mentioned last week, his GP would only allow him to take part in the expedition if he, as long as he made sure that his heart rate didn't go above 120 beats per minute. Randall Fiennes forgot to take his heart rate monitor with him, so he completed the expedition not knowing what rate his heart was beating at all. And so this is an aspect of his personality where it's like sort of daring do, and let's just get on and do the job and not worry about all these like little technicalities kind of thing. And so that's all part of the picture of the man, really.
Single-mindedness, and always going to make his way through right till the end. Finish the job regardless, no matter what, even if he has a heart attack or gets frostbite or anything else.
And then it mentions online the fact that in 2010 he was involved in a three-car collision in Stockport, which resulted in minor injuries to himself but serious injuries to the driver of one of the other cars. He'd been in Stockport to participate in the annual High Peak Marathon in Derbyshire as part of a veterans team known as Poles Apart, and despite the freezing conditions managed to win the veterans trophy in just over 12 hours. So, you know, again, he, as recently as 2010, he has been taking part. So he would have been 66, 67-ish years of age at that point there. And if we move on now to awards and recognition, there's like a whole list of things that he's been awarded as he's gone through his life, because, you couldn't be as active as he's been. You couldn't take on and complete the challenges, etc., that he's taken on without people taking notice and without people wanting to give you awards for it. And so in 1968, while serving with the Omani Army, Ranulph Fiennes received the Dhofar Campaign Medal, and in 1970 received the Sultan of Oman's Bravery Medal. He's also been awarded a number of honorary doctorates, the first in 1986 at Loughborough University, followed in 1995 by the University of Central England, in 2000 the University of Portsmouth, in 2006 Glasgow Caledonian University, in 2005 the University of Sheffield, 2007 the University of Abertay Dundee, September 2011 the University of Plymouth, Fiennes later received the Royal Geographical Society's Founders Medal. So he's been recognised in, by an enormous number of institutions there.
That's weird, isn't it? I would have, you would think if somebody's a doctor, they get, if they've actually studied to become a doctor, they just do the studying the once and they become a doctor. I mean, how many times has he been given an honorary doctorship? I mean, what is he? Is it a doctor in various different disciplines that they give
him? No. He doesn't have to study to be a doctor. When you're given an honorary doctor, it's just like being given a medal in honor of things that you've achieved in your own particular field. So these would have been doctorates that would have been awarded to him for his fundraising, I would imagine, and for the his expeditionary exploits.
But he's already got one. If he's already got a doctorate, he's been made a doctor by the University of Plymouth, and then Glasgow says, "Well, we're going to make you into a doctor as well." And then another part of the country.
Because it's these different institutions that want to honour him, you see, and so they all honour him by individually giving him honorary doctorates to their learning institution.
I guess they can, they can say they've got a connection with him then as well. He can become like a patron.
And what will often then happen is that when they have prize, I can't think, what do they call it, where they hand out the scrolls when all the students pass their degrees, very often they have a celebrity come and hand out the scrolls and also speak to the assembled students as well, and they want somebody that's going to be a celebrity and somebody that's going to be inspirational and somebody who can tell a good yarn, basically. And I think that Ranulph Fiennes fits the bill as far as all those three things are concerned.
Yeah, it'd be great to be handed your award by him, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And in 1982, he was the subject of This Is Your Life with Eamon Andrews. Do you remember that TV program? You may be a bit young.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
You too, right? Mm-hmm. So he was caught by Eamon Andrews. And then he was awarded the Livingstone Gold Medal by the Royal Scottish Geographical Society. And so, again, this would have been another medal that he would have been given in honour of the sort of life that he'd led and the expeditions that he'd successfully completed, etc. And again, in 1984, he was awarded the New York Explorers Club Gold Medal and was described in that year, as we've mentioned previously, by the Guinness Book of Records as the world's greatest living explorer. And the fact that he's been receiving these accolades internationally goes some way to substantiating what the Guinness Book of Records stated, that he is the world's greatest living explorer. Because if you were asked to name another explorer who's achieved more than Ranulf Fiennes has, you would have great difficulty coming up with a name, I think. In 1986, he was awarded the Polar Medal for outstanding service to British polar exploration and research. And so that was for reaching one of the poles. I'm not sure whether it was Antarctic or Antarctica that he reached first. But then he reached the other pole on foot, and so he's got the Polar Medal with, I think the term is dual clasps, which is like having a military medal and bar, so that he's got both those medals. And I think he is the only person to have a Polar Medal and with dual clasps. And so, again, that's another thing that is outstanding about him there. And then he was awarded an OBE in 1993 for human endeavour and for charitable services. And so the Queen and the government at the time recognised the outstanding contribution he'd made. And the figure I've got noted down here confirms the figure I mentioned earlier on, that he'd raised at that point £14 million for good causes. And along the way, if we just look at the causes that he'd raised the money for, in 1992, he raised $4.2 million for the Multiple Sclerosis Society. 1995, $1.6 million for Breakthrough to Breast Cancer. 2004-2005, he raised $2.3 million for the British Heart Foundation. 2007-2009, $6.5 million for Marie Curie. In 2013, $2 million for the charity Seeing is Believing. And then in 2015, there's an undisclosed amount that he's raised for Marie Curie. And in the year 2000, he was awarded the Explorers Club Millennium Award for Navigation. In May 2007, he received ITV's Greatest Britons Award for sport, beating fellow nominees Lewis Hamilton and Joe Calzaghe. So again, that's sort of an indication of in the great esteem that he's held in by the British public. In October 2007, Fiennes ranked 94th, tying with five other people in a list of the top 100 living geniuses published by the Daily Telegraph. So again, despite the fact that he failed his O-levels, he is one of the top 100 living geniuses.
Yeah, it's good to see that he's being mentioned in the same sort of sphere as scientists and astronauts and physicists and all that sort of thing for being such an amazing explorer. Yeah, it's not often you hear of explorers mentioned as being geniuses, is it? It's usually academics that are classed as that.
So in late 2008, early 2009, he took part in a new BBC program called Top Dogs, Adventures in War, Sea and Ice, in which he teamed up with fellow Britain's John Simpson and BBC News of the World Affairs editor, Sir Robin Knox-Johnson. I got that the wrong way around. So John Simpson is the BBC News World Affairs editor, and Sir Robin Knox-Johnson, the round-the-world yachtsman. So they teamed up, and the team undertook three trips, with each team member experiencing the other's adventure field. First episode aired in March 2009, which saw Fiennes, Simpson and Knox Johnson go on a news gathering trip to Afghanistan. Then the team reported from the Khyber Pass and the Tora Bora mountain complex. And in the other two episodes, they undertook a voyage around Cape Horn and an expedition hauling sledges across the deep frozen Frobisher Bay in the far north of Canada. So again, it's sort of TV programs that he took part in that were documentary in nature, but which were done to give people a flavour of the areas of excellence that these three men excelled in, basically. In 2010, Fiennes was named the UK's top celebrity fundraiser by Just Giving after raising more than $2.5 million for Marie Curie Cancer Care over the previous 2 years, more than any other celebrity fundraiser featured on justgiving.com during the same period. In September 2011, Fiennes was awarded an honorary doctorate in science from Plymouth University, and in 2012 was awarded an honorary fellowship of the University of Glamorgan. In December 2012, he was named one of the Men of the Year for 2012 by Top Gear magazine. And then in October 2014, it was announced that Fiennes would receive an honorary doctorate of science from the University of Chester in recognition of outstanding and inspirational contribution in the field of exploration. So Anna Fiennes is now 76 years old and lives at Greenlands, a rambling hill farm in the wilds of Exmoor, with his second wife, Louise Millington, their daughter, Elizabeth, and his son, Alexander.
He certainly achieved a lot, hasn't he? I guess next week we'll have a closer look at some of the challenges that he's done and his rum making as well. Well, let's start with a brief recap of what we did last week. We talked about Ranulph Fiennes and the books that he'd written, the fact that he was a fiction author, as well as writing up his exploits and his expeditions. We talked about we sort of tried to make a guess at what his political views were. We said that he may have unofficially supported UKIP. He certainly hasn't officially supported them. He was clearly a traditionalist because he destroyed that Hollywood dam that was put in the village. We talked about some of his media appearances where he was an advisor for a lot of programs dealing with survival. We talked about his marriage and how his first wife, she died sadly due to cancer, which may have affected his choice in who he was going to do his charity work for, because it was for Marie Curie. We talked about some of the injuries which he's had, the heart attacks, the frostbite, cutting his own fingers off. We talked about many, many, many awards that he's actually been given, a long string of awards. That's about where we got to last week. And we're going to go into a little bit more detail about some of the expeditions that he went into now. But do you want to add anything to that recap from last week, Max?
Well, only really that a lot of the expeditions and a lot of the awards have been won during a period that in his life where Ranulph Fiennes has been rather older than most people would imagine an explorer and an adventurer to be. And I think that this, as an individual, he serves as an inspiration to other people who perhaps have entered middle age and who are perhaps tempted to think that the best of their lives might be behind them, because as Ranulph Fiennes has shown, that you can still do good things and do some of your best work in later in life.
He's a very good example for middle-aged people to follow, I think. Well, the first of these expeditions I picked here was from 2007, when he was 63 years of age, and he climbed the north face of the Eiger, which is a particularly hard, sheer cliff face that he climbed up. Ranulph Fiennes succeeded in climbing the notorious north face of the Eiger in the Bernese Alps, Switzerland, along with Kenton Cool and Ian Parnell. The climb was made even harder for Ranulph due to the frostbite on his left hand. Without the ends of his fingers to get a grip, the sheer rock face was particularly difficult, and he often had to rely on his axes to climb. The challenge raised £1.8 million for Marie Curie and was possible thanks to generous funding by Paul Sykes. Now, that's incredible, that. I mean, when you're climbing, all of it is about just the, getting the little tips of your fingers into a little crevice, and that, and that's what you hold yourself up with. And he was forced to just hammer his adds into the cliff face and then pull himself up. I mean, just to think of doing that without, I mean, it's effectively, you know, not being able to use your left hand to climb, and yet he was still able to climb up one of the most difficult climbs in the world, the north face of the Eiger. Do you want to comment on this at all, Max?
Well, just to say that it's, you know, an amazing accomplishment. And yeah, I agree with everything that you said. You know, if you people may think that just having the tips of your fingers missing wouldn't really affect your grip to any great extent. But if you imagine not being able to wrap your fingers around, even just, you know, if you're using an axe to climb with, not being able to wrap your fingers quite as far around the handle of the axe as you would do if you'd got all of your fingers there, you know, that is a significant handicap, and just makes the feat even more remarkable.
I mean, that is one sport, rock climbing, that you need to have your fingertips there for. I mean, he really did pick one of the worst things he possibly could have done with regards to his injury there, trying to climb up the north face of the Eiger. In 2014, at the age of 70, he attempted what was called the coldest journey. Ranoff and his team attempted to cross the Antarctic plateau in the polar winter. It was one of the hardest expeditions ever attempted because of the weather conditions. Temperatures would drop to minus 90 degrees centigrade and it would be almost permanently dark. Unfortunately, Ranoff had to turn back after a skiing accident. Trying to fix his ski binding, he was forced to remove his gloves in temperatures around minus 30 degrees centigrade, and while the gloves were off only for a short amount of time, the temperature gave one of his hands severe frostbite. After a medical checkup when he returned home, diabetes may have been a contributing factor. So not only has he had these heart attacks, not only has he had these kidney stones, he lost his fingers due to the frostbite, he's also got diabetes. Now, I've been in temperatures of minus 40 degrees with the wind chill. I think it was probably about minus 15 degrees without that. And that was really, really cold. I mean, the cold goes right through to your bone. To say that, I mean, he was going through the Antarctic plateau in temperatures of minus 90 degrees and almost permanently dark. I mean, you can imagine that just the sunlight would be such a blessing, just to see the sun in a situation like that where you were so cold. Just the sight of it, I think, would probably warm you up. What do you make of this one that he did at age 70, Max?
Well, yeah, I don't think we can reiterate enough just what an inspiration Ranoff Fiennes is. You know, one of the stories that I often tell is where I read Jack London's Mutiny on the Elsinore, which describes the first mate, who's like one of the main characters of the book, but he's described there by Jack London as being a man 70 years of age who still has retained the strength of his youth, isn't quite as mobile as perhaps he would have been, but he still clambers around in the rigging and still gives the sailors, when they're being lazy, a bit of a kick up the backside and a slap round the head in order to keep them in line and to keep them working hard. And I've often pointed out to people that if ever they are approaching their, or, you know, entering their sort of sixth decade of life, and they, or their seventh decade of life, and they're starting to feel that age is getting the better of them, that they should read Jack London's book. But I would also suggest to them that they read Sir Ranoff Fiennes' biography as well, as an inspiration to make them realize that if they're determined enough, and that they are single-minded enough and plan ahead, etc., then they can still achieve great things even at an advanced age.
Yes, and he did that with diabetes as well. So you say that people that have got, you know, that have had illnesses, that shouldn't really be holding people back either. I should imagine that he has to exercise every day and keeps up with a lot of exercise when he's getting ready for these expeditions. In 2015, he did the Marathon des Sables, or des Sables, and that was at age 71. Ranoff completed the toughest foot race on Earth in aid of Marie Curie. The race itself is 156 miles long, 251 kilometers. Takes place in the Saharan Desert and lasted 6 days. Temperatures reach 50 degrees centigrade in the desert, and Ranulf had to carry all his personal equipment. The toughest part of the challenge was the double marathon day, when he had to run two marathons back to back in the searing heat. By completing the challenge, he became the oldest Briton ever to do so. And that's incredible to think that he's having to carry all his camping equipment with him. And he's having to stay out overnight, get up again the next day and run another marathon day after day after day in this heat. Two marathons within one day at the age of 71. It's just, you know, incredible what the human body can do if you keep yourself fit and healthy. And you're continually pushing the boundaries. You read about these great feats of our ancestors, and Ranulf Fiennes is showing that it's still possible to do these things today. I think we talked a little bit about this marathon in the first episode, Max.
Yeah, it is a series of marathons rather than just a single race. I think it's six marathons on the trot, a marathon each day, or presumably with one day where you do a double marathon. But it's running a marathon in the absolute searing heat of the desert rather than in the freezing cold of the Arctic or the Antarctic, which is perhaps what Ranulf Fiennes would have been more used to. But I know of people who have taken part in these kind of super marathons. I used to know a chap who used to do these kind of marathons over the Rocky Mountains in the United States, and I was absolutely sort of awestruck listening to his accounts of what he had achieved. But he was, you know, a young guy in his sort of late 20s at that point in time, to do something which is comparable, but with heat rather than cold being one of the main things that fatigue you, and to do it at Ranulf Fiennes' age is just absolutely amazing. And each one of these challenges that we hear about just really adds to our respect for him as an explorer and an adventurer.
And the money that he raises for it, isn't it? That's a big part of it, yeah, as well.
And an athlete, I should have added on that list of things as well, because as we've just established, you've got to be a considerable athlete to do these sort of things.
When we talked about Shackleton, we were talking about how he had to raise all this money to go out to the Antarctic in order to be the first to do these things and do the scientific work. And also we've talked about the large amount of money that needed to be raised in order to do things like go out and discover Australia and things like that. But what we've got here is he's got to raise the money to go on the trip, but then he's also raising money for charity as well. So he's actually making a lot of money for these charities. He's not just spending the money on being the first person to do this or breaking this world record. And the actual amount of planning and preparation that goes into these things is just incredible. I've got one more expedition here, which I think was one of his first expeditions, the Transglobal Expedition. Preparation took almost an entire decade, beginning in 1972 and not actually leaving England until 1979. The trekking team, led by Fiennes and including fellow Britons Charles Burton and Oliver Shepherd, had a support crew of some 36 people, including Ginny, his wife. So they've got a dozen people for each man on the trip. I mean, that is a big support crew. A lot of people are involved in making it possible so that he can do these things. During the 84,000 kilometer, 52,000 mile expedition, the explorers survived a polar bear attack, the loss of crucial supplies, and 3 months of being marooned on a drifting ice floe. So he must have got some idea of what it was like for Shackleton being marooned on this ice floe. And I tried to find information about the polar bear attack, but I was unable to. The Telegraph had something about it, but you had to sign up and pay some money to actually find out about it. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to get any details on that, because that sounds pretty interesting as well. Surviving a polar bear attack. I don't know if they had rifles with them. They must have had something to protect themselves against an attack like that. Have you heard about that one before? Max?
No, that's news to me, actually. I didn't realise that he had been confronted with a polar bear on one of these expeditions. But again, it sort of just adds to the the legend, really, doesn't it, of a man who doesn't let anything stand in his way. I fairly recently watched the film The Revenant again, and I can sort of clearly imagine what a polar bear attack must be like. And yeah, it's not the sort of thing that most people would want to entertain.
I should imagine he probably writes about that in his books, if anyone reads his autobiography. Well, they departed from Greenwich and attempted to stay as close as possible to the Greenwich Meridian as they journeyed southwards over land and water until they reached the coast of Antarctica in January 1980. So that's about a year it's taken them to get to there. And they basically did this without any motorized transport. It was, without flying. It was all over land and all over sea, basically. They did use motorized transport. They just didn't use flight. They remained there until October when Fiennes, Burton and Shepherd departed on snowmobiles for the South Pole, which they reached on December the 15th. Setting out again after a short time at the American base there, they arrived at the Scott base on the west coast of Antarctica in mid-January 1981, having made the continental traverse in a record-setting 67 days. So they broke the record for making it across the continent there. There they were met by their support ship, and over the next several months they voyaged northwards through the Pacific Ocean to western Alaska. They then headed east and north in an open boat through the Northwest Passage to Canada before proceeding on foot in September to the settlement of Alert on the Ellesmere Islands' northern shore. And again, being in an open boat, that must have reminded him of being how Shackleton was in the lifeboats. They were open boats that they had. After wintering there for 5 months, the pair set out for the North Pole in mid-February 1982, arriving on April the 11th after an arduous trek by snowmobile and sledge. The journey home was no less challenging, hampered by difficult ice conditions and stretches of open water. After the two spent more than 3 months on a drifting ice floe, the Benjamin Bowring was able to retrieve them and sail home to Britain. The expedition arrived back in Greenwich in August, some 3 years after they had first departed and after having travelled some 52,000 miles. So I think it was eight years in preparation and 3 years to do the trip, just following the Greenwich Meridian line right the way around the world. And he was asked what it is that keeps him going in these instances. And he said, there'll be a voice in my head saying I'll have a heart attack or I'll get hypothermia or I've got a family and it's stupid to carry on. Well, that sort of wimpish voice tries to appear logical, finding reasons for stopping, and you just have to fight it. I've had it so many times. So it's just single-mindedness, gritty determination, single-mindedness, strength of will, and determination to succeed in the task that he has set himself. I would also probably add that also all the work that he puts into it and the preparation. And he obviously makes sure that he's done enough exercise that he's able to handle these sorts of challenges. But then also you've got to have this positive mindset at the same time. It's got to be a combination of both being extremely physically fit and also having this strength of will. But I do believe while he was on this expedition, there was some kind of a tradition that he picked up on that gave rise to him making his own rum or something, Max. Do you want to?
This is what's referred to as the 1730 Club, and it's not really the same sort of thing as the 1830 Club that some people might be familiar with. I mean, the 1730 Club was something that was suggested by one of the expedition members, Oliver Shepherd at the time, and this was during the, I think it was the travel across the Northwest Passage, and Oliver Shepherd then suggested this idea, which is that no matter where they are in the world, and no matter what they're struggling to do, they should always take time at 5:30 in the evening to drink a glass of rum and to toast their successes. And this is something that Ranulph Fiennes' expedition teams adopted as a convention from that point onwards. And having returned to the UK, Ranulph Fiennes decided that he would set about distilling a rum in his own name, and he joined forces with a master distiller who was Dr. John Walters, I think the name is, and they have together produced a rum which is now being marketed as the Spirit of Adventure, Sir Ranulph Fiennes Great British Rum. And having found out that this was for sale, I decided that I would like to sample this. And so I contacted the firm concerned and got myself a bottle of rum. And it's a very nice bottle of rum. It's a very it's a pale rum, and it's got a very what should I say? Is a very smooth and subtle taste to it. It's it tastes rather different to any other rum that I've tasted. And apparently, the distilling process employed by John Walters is different from traditional distilling processes. And in particular, with this rum, instead of distilling the rum and then putting the rum into perhaps sherry barrels or something of that sort, and then aging it in the sherry barrels so that the rum would absorb the color and some of the flavor from the sherry barrels, they charred some of the wood from three of Ranulph Fiennes' expeditions, and they put that wood actually in the still with the spirit that they were brewing. And the three types of wood are sequoia from the expedition that Sir Ranulph Fiennes conducted in British Columbia. They've got pine from the Norwegian expedition across the Jostelsbreen Glacier, and also date palm wood from Oman, where Sir Ranulph Fiennes discovered the lost city of Ubar, and you can certainly taste a kind of a woody flavour in the actual rum. And it's not a cheap rum. It's a sort of a premium price, and so it's £49 for a bottle. But it is an excellent rum. And what I can say here is that looking at some of their publicity blurb they've got here, the 1730 Club was born and still exists to this very day, from sailing the seven seas to the pirates of the Caribbean, scaling great heights to plumbing the ocean's depths. Rum has been associated with adventure. It's the spirit of daring do and no holds barred, of nothing is impossible. It's the spirit that takes your loftiest ambitions and puts the fire in your belly to achieve higher, further, greater than you ever thought possible. We have a unique flavour that can only come from the spirit coming into contact with the barrel. Instead of sitting in that barrel for 5 years, though, we put the barrel in the still. We're using exotic woods from some of Sir Ranulph Fiennes' most iconic expeditions, sequoia from Canada, Norwegian pine, and date palm from Oman, to deliver multiple adventures in one bottle. Distilling wood to extract the right flavours may sound simple, but make no mistake, plenty can go wrong in the extraction. Only the skill of a true master distiller can pull off the feat successfully. The result is a golden spirit with a distinctly British character. And so it is a drink that I can heartily recommend. And obviously, some of it will go to benefits Dr. John Walters. And some of the profit from this, I would imagine, will go to benefits Ranulph Fiennes. And so if he's the sort of character, the sort of person that you admire and you'd like to feel that you have shared to some extent in his life and his successes, then this is a sort of product that you might want to invest in.
I think the tradition was started, it says, December 30th, 1979, on board the MV Benjamin Bowring. So it must be right at the beginning of the Trans-Global Expedition. They decided that they would have this tradition every day, and toast toast their success and the support of the crew and the beloved ones. And apparently every day they do that. Raise a toast high into the air to the expedition, to friends and to family back home. So that must have really helped out to have that little bit of the day that they look forward to, where they raise their spirits and thought of their family back home and just gave themselves a little reward at 5:30 every day. It's important to give yourself a little reward every so often for your hard work, I think. And that's quite acceptable, that, just to have a tot of rum, I think. So you would definitely recommend that then, Max.
Yeah, and I think that one thing to think back on is that in days of old, sailors and soldiers, particularly during the sort of 17 and 1800s, when soldiers used to wear red coats and bearskin hats, and they would march shoulder to shoulder into a withering hail of the enemy's fire, etc. In those sort of days, they needed something to give them a bit of Dutch courage. And so before battles, soldiers were given a mug of rum. And before sea battles, sailors were given a mug of rum as well, so that they would be inclined to do the sort of feats of derring do that the previous quote that I read out sort of referred to. And I think that you know, it's a tradition that's got a distinctly British kind of aspect to it. In that respect.
I didn't realise that. I always thought, you know, Jamaican rum, I thought it was something to do with Jamaica. You know, I've learned something new here, that it was a British tradition, this drinking of the rum. And I believe he's still involved in these challenges. He's got a current challenge at the moment, has he, Max? The Global Reach Challenge?
That's right. So Sir Arnold Fiennes has announced his next record-breaking challenge, in which he will be risking life and limb to raise vital funds for the charity Marie Curie again. The Intrepid Explorer is attempting to complete the Global Reach Challenge and become the first person to have crossed both polar ice caps and climbed the highest mountain on each continent. So he's covered both global ice caps, and he's climbed Mount Everest. He's climbed the Eiger, which isn't quite the highest mountain in Europe, but now he's going to complete another challenge where he crosses both the polar ice caps and then climbs those highest mountains on each continent. And so, again, that's another really challenging expedition for him. And for a man who's now in his 70s, it makes it an even more challenging thing for him to take on. And he has a Just Giving page, which can be found on the internet, and he has already raised £316,000. Well, that much money has been pledged to him in connection with this challenge. And so, again, if somebody admires Ranulph Fiennes and wants to contribute towards his further success, then that, again, might be something that our listeners might wish to contribute to.
With the advances in modern technology as well, I mean, you would hope that he would be sort of recording a video diary from this as well. So it says that people can follow his progress over the coming months, as well as support his challenge at that Just Giving site. So I would hope that he had some kind of a blog, and he was just making a little recording of what he had done that day, so that people could follow that as well. And he's also doing a speaking tour. I know you've already been to see him once, Max. Do you know any more about this speaking tour that he's going to be doing this year?
Well, the speaking tour has been interrupted somewhat by the coronavirus situation. The very next speaking occasion I can see on the calendar is booked for the 10th of October 2020 at the Lighthouse Theatre in Kettering. But there are other dates that have been booked, which are for Yeovil, Barnstable, Poole, Bristol, Blackpool, Dorking, Plymouth, and many, many other places as well. And the website to look for is www.ent-tommy.s24/UK/tour-dates/Sir-Ranulph-Fiennes. And if you look for that link, then that will give you the program of speaking dates that are there for the future. The speaking, that the fee to go and listen to him speak is approximately £30. With some of them, it's a little bit more than £30. With some, it's a little bit less than £30. Yes, I did hear him speak years back. And he is an inspirational speaker as well. And I think when you actually meet the man and meet somebody who has accomplished all the things that he's accomplished, you can't help but be inspired by their story. And so I would say to anybody who likes this sort of thing, anybody who has ever had a yearning to be an explorer or to take part in an expedition or anything of that sort, or who's got an adventurous spirit and wants to have contact with somebody who's not just talk the talk but walk the walk, then going to one of these speaking occasions would be a great thing to do.
Yeah, £30 well spent, I would say. I think you can get tickets as well at sirranulphfines.co.uk. Thank you very much for listening, and do watch out in future for more Greatest Britons at radioalbion.com.